all, I'm so glad that our esteemed friends, Professor, Professor Roshes, they are both of them are present here today. And Professor Devan Patel has really introduced in a classical style, introduced me, which tells us how to deal with the problem of today. And he gave me the problem, with the problem itself creates so many problems before me. There are two classicals in the question. What is classical in classical Sanskrit literature? Is that the question? So, first of all, we have to understand what is classical. What does that classical mean? I looked at the Oxford Dictionary that says of recognized high quality. That is one of the meanings that Oxford Dictionary tells us of the first classical. The second classical also creates a problem before me. Should we take it as a Paninian language as distinct from the Vedic language? Of course, Panini does not say anything about all this, but Patanjali has said something. He says that there are two languages. He only distinguishes between two languages. One he calls Laukika, that is the worldly, day-to-day use language, and the other he calls Vaidika, that is a language specific to the Vedas. So had we accepted that, our problem would have been simpler. But one of the commentators on Patanjali, he creates another problem before me. He says, Kayata says, that there is no difference between Vaidika and Laukika language. Even Vaidika language is Laukika language. Then why does Patanjali say Laukikanang Vaidikanang cha? Kayata says that it is just in the way in which there was invitation to all Brahmins to be present on some auspicious occasion. So somebody made a statement that all Brahmins have come and Vasishtha has also come. Does it mean that Vasishtha is not a Brahmin? So it is just like that. So Vedic language is to give a special, specific respect to that tradition. Patanjali has separately mentioned Laukikanang Vaidikanang cha. That's how Kayata tells us. So I don't know where to begin and where to end. That means we have to begin with the Rig Veda, and I don't know where to end, because he himself has said that even now, novels, poems, plays are being contributed in Sanskrit, what we call classical Sanskrit today. There are more than 200 Sanskrit journals being published in India even today. So where to begin and where to end, I am myself not very clear. But we will confine to what I call Sanskrit tradition of India. And if at all we have to define just one distinct character of that Sanskrit tradition, we could say this tradition is an inclusive tradition that includes everything. That includes spirituality, that includes materialism, that includes intellectual disciplines of various types. There is nothing on the earth, no element of life or individual that does not find a place in that tradition. You already know that the Vedas themselves have 6 angas. And those 6 angas, those 6 accessories of the Vedas, they include phonetics. That is the first thing, first item, Shiksha they call it. There are ritual manuals, ethical manuals, Shrauta Kalpa and Smarta Kalpa. Vyakarana is very much there. Vyakarana you can call linguistics, descriptive linguistics, as Paninian tradition believes in it. And we are so happy to have a grammarian like Professor Cardona here, who has spent all his time in studying Panini. So Vyakarana is very much there. Etymology is very much there. Every day we talk about etymology, Nirukta. Metrics is there. And I will talk to you something about metrics, how metrics is such an important discipline in Sanskrit. Astronomy, astrology, mathematics, everything is there. Then there are 4 Upangas, they call it, or Upavedas, they call it. And those 4 Upavedas are Ayurveda, that deals with science of life, science of living, prevention, maintenance of positive health, prevention of ailments, and also treatment of various mental and physical diseases. There is a science of the Gandharva Veda, musicology is very much there. There is also Dhanurveda, Vikandri is there. And there is also Artha Veda that deals with political science and other philosophy and other branches. So these are the 4 Upavedas, they call it. Apart from all this, there are epics and Puranas. Ramayana is there. Ramayana and Mahabharata, they are considered to be the great epics of India. 18 Puranas and the same number of Upapuranas are also there. Dharma Shastras are there. The various schools of philosophy are there. What is not there? Kama Shastra is there, Dharma Shastra is there, Artha Shastra is there. So, it is such a vast amount of literature, this what we call Sanskrit literature has, that we get everything. And what Mahabharata claims about itself, Dharme Yartheta, Kamecha, Moksha, Purusharshava, यदिहास्ति तदन्यत्र यन्नेहास्ति न तत् क्वचित्. So this is the corpus of what we call Sanskrit literature. And fortunately for us, right since 18th century, of course the first reaction was somewhat different, but ultimately it so happened that the importance of Sanskrit as a global heritage was recognized by the world. And thanks to this university and other universities in this country, in Germany, in UK, in France, in Italy, Sweden and other countries, that Sanskrit literature is no longer confined only to Indian Union, but it has become a global heritage. It has taken the shape of a global heritage, and it is one of the members of the vast Indo-European family. It is one of the members of linguistic groups belonging to Southeast Asia. I don't know where it is not present in some form or the other. It has given, it has taken, both ways it has functioned. It has been functioning, and still now it is functioning. Now let us see some of the things which create a sort of dichotomy between classical status of Sanskrit and the status of modern disciplines. I will cite just one small example. After India got independence, a constituent assembly was formed, and a few lawmakers like Ambedkar, one Kailasnath Katju and others, they suggested that Sanskrit should be the official language of Indian Union. But that proposal was not accepted by that constituent assembly on the ground that it was regarded as a classical language, not as a modern language. So that's a common sense view about Sanskrit. But ultimately, the same constituent assembly recognized the importance of Sanskrit despite its being a classical language, and they listed this language in the 8th schedule to the constitution. And not only that, if you look at the Indian currency notes, you will find Sanskrit inscription also on all of them. And even otherwise, they made a statement about Sanskrit that wherever modern technical terms are to be framed, they should take help from the Sanskrit language, and that was also accepted by them unanimously. But what is it that prevents Sanskrit from being considered as a modern discipline? That we have to think. I must tell you my experience while I was the president of the International Association of Sanskrit Studies. We had decided to celebrate 2000 as the year of Sanskrit and other classical traditions of the world. But I had some bitter experience there. some of my colleagues didn't agree to adding other classical languages in my plans, saying that other classical traditions do not invite us to their conferences, so why should we act otherwise? In fact, I had gone too far. I had, in fact, at that time I was a visiting professor in Columbia University. I had invited some of my classics colleagues there. In fact, at that time I was also studying formally the Attic Greek also. I did something, but then I think I have forgotten all that. So, and I had discussed with them the need to bring about a classical spirit in the real sense of the term in our society, in human society. And as Oxford Dictionary tells us, classical spirit is that spirit which is of a recognized high standard. That is number one. And I add to that the other point, that classical spirit unites us. And of course I won't say that modern spirit divides us all the time, but the fact remains that if we could really imbibe a classical spirit, that spirit, for example, Romance languages, they constitute one group. So if one is proficient in Latin, he will have little difficulty in understanding Spanish, French, Italian, Portuguese. If one is proficient in Gothic or Old Germanic, he will be able to appreciate more the other languages of that group. If this Indo-European group, if it is really has the spirit of togetherness, this will be a big group, even politically speaking. Politically speaking, socially speaking. So, classical spirit, I think, it gives respect to modernity, and what is most important with classical spirit is its continuity. And Sanskrit tradition also tells us about this, the spirit of continuity, time and again. It reminds us of that. Three types of depths that we are having: the Pitridana, the Devarina, and the Rishirana. The depths, three types of depths. Devan Patelji was mentioning about Professor Emenu, and I still remember Professor Brown. I still remember Ingalls, Edgerton. I remember Professor Lessing. In his old days, he was in his 90s, and every day he was coming, he was having an armchair in his chamber. He was resting there and working and working and working all the time. So even now, if you want to seek inspiration, so from that Rishirana, if you do something, if you contribute, make some contributions, and if we remember them, Professor Emenu, Professor Edgerton, Brown, and others, so they serve as sources of inspiration for us. And similarly, this Devarena is also there. We may believe in it or we may not believe in it, no problem. But to have connections, to have transcendental connections, that is one of the spirits of this classical tradition, that it transcends geographical and historical limits very often, and it unites us. And in Sanskrit tradition, all at once we are united with Bhur, Bhuva, Swa, all the three worlds or whatever cosmos. Ayurveda also tells us the same thing. Ayurveda also tells us that if you want to be healthy, so you must have the wish to survive, the wish to earn your livelihood, and the wish to have connections, transcendental connections. That also is a must for every individual who wants to be happy. Otherwise, if we are confined to the situations in which we are, we really feel bored with that situation. So, to have a universal mind, that is one of the goals of that classical spirit. I was talking about that tradition, that intellectual tradition of knowledge that is enshrined in this classical tradition or in this Sanskrit tradition. Let us first of all see the metrics about which I wanted to tell you something. Chanda Shastra, one of the six accessories of Vedic literature, how relevant it is still now before us. That Chanda Shastra, apart from giving the definitions of the various meters, it provides some material which, to quote Mr. Knuthen of University of California, Berkeley, he was of the view, we may or may not agree with him, he was of the view that it was for Indian metricians to evolve what we call binary system of notation. And our metricians use four methods, four techniques to describe the various permutations and combinations of various types of meters. And there, of course, it will be a separate paper, someday we will talk about that. But you can, in a second, you can tell that such and such meter type will have so many permutations and combinations, so many millions of such and such. And you can tell in a few seconds, you can say that. How many hats, how many gurus, how many laghus, that also. I have asked several people, they are unable to explain how it happens, but it happens. And there is a, they call it lagakriya, that in a second you can tell that how many meters will have so many laghus, so many gurus, and how many will have all laghus and all gurus. Of course, it is very difficult to explain in such a short time, but it's a wonderful mathematical magic, I should say, and how it works nobody has yet been able to tell me how it works. But it works so, it is the system is so simple. And then how to combine the various types of situations. So this Sanskrit tradition, as we have initially stated, it is all inclusive tradition, and that picture we find everywhere. Even the philosophical systems tell us. For example, the three gunas are there. Now these three gunas, how do they coexist? So they are dependent on each other. They coexist with each other. They generate each other, and they also overcome each other. And in spite of all that, they coexist with each other. Anyonya, abhibhava, ashraya, janana, mithuna, vrittayascha, guna. So you see there, anyonya is there, abhibhava is there, ashraya is there, janana is there, and mithuna is there. They coexist. Even Ayurveda tells us the same thing. The three doshas, they also coexist, and they do not kill each other, despite their mutually contradictory qualities. And they say, for that, the Ayurveda tells us a very typical word they give, sahaja satmya. They have a sort of natural instinct of coexistence. Sahaja satmya. Natural wholesome instinct of coexistence they have. So they say, to quote Charaka Sanghita again, viruddhairapi natu ete gunaih ghnanti parasparam doshah sahaja satmyatvat vishanghoram ahiniva. To give an example of the poison that every snake has. The snake has all that poison, but that poison does not kill it. It kills others, but it does not kill it. So these doshas, these dhatus, they coexist without killing each other because of this natural, wholesome instinct of coexistence. So this natural, wholesome instinct of coexistence you find everywhere, all throughout, in philosophical texts, in literature, everywhere you find this. Even in Kalidasa, Nisarga Bhinnaspada, Nisarga Bhinnaspada Metat Dvayam Srishcha Saraswati Cha. This such and such king, he has the, even though the Saraswati and Lakshmi, they are contradictory to each other, but they coexist in him. So this emphasis is everywhere, this inclusiveness that Sanskrit tradition has all throughout. And along with this inclusiveness, Sanskrit tradition also has some advices. There is nothing like absolute advice in this Sanskrit tradition. Sanskrit tradition all the time talks about ahimsa paramo dharmaha. Patanjali also tells us ahimsa paramo dharmaha. At the same time, our literature also tells us that when something happens, when somebody, Adadai, comes and he is destroying the peace of society, that ahimsa will not work. Jaina philosophy tells us the same thing. That is not hinsa. If you deal with such undesirable elements firmly, that hinsa is no hinsa, that is ahimsa itself. So how beautifully that point has been presented by Magha in his Shishupala Vatham. It says, Anyada Bhushanam Pumsam Kshama Lajjeva Yoshitam Parakrama Paribhave Vaiyatyam Surate Shiva. So everywhere our literature, the Sanskrit literature, beginning with Vedas and ending, I don't know where, even now it is very much there. It always tells us about, it pleads about that inclusiveness. And thank God, now the extent of that inclusiveness has grown enough, and that Sanskrit tradition is not confined only to India. It is everywhere, in this university, in Columbia University, in California, in the various universities of Europe, where it is not. So this classical spirit, and whenever we talk about wherever there is a dichotomy between classical spirit and modernity, I think we have enough grounds to tell the so-called modernists that classical spirit does not deny modernity. Everywhere it is very much there. Even, for example, political science. If you look at the Mahabharata, Rajadharma, you will find that Mahabharata also thinks of a society where there will be no ruler, there will be no ruled, there will be no magistrate, there will be no culprit, nothing will be there. There will be no crime, but this did not happen all the time. There was a situation like that, but slowly and gradually there was a need for a king. So Brahma created somebody who could be a king, and the very name that he had, his name was Viraja, that he had no rajoguna at all. So he came and he was asked to rule the world or rule the country. But as he had no rajoguna, how could he rule? So he denied. He didn't accept that position, and he was engaged in conducting austerities. Then somebody undesirable person, when desirable people, intellectuals, when they are not alive to the situation of the world or of the society, then some undesirable people come in and they dominate. And that's what is happening somewhere also, here, there and everywhere it happens. So an undesirable king came. But that undesirable king, instead of ruling, he created a situation of imbalance all throughout. That was not tolerated by the intellectuals. And symbolically, out of that pseudo-king, out of his hands, the sages could create a real king, Prithu, by whose name the earth is now described like prithvi, that is from prithu, whatever it is. So that prithu came, and if you go through the various lessons that he obtained from the rishis, one of the lessons was vidvadvihi eki bhava. The administration, political administration, cannot be perfect unless there is some association with intellectuals. If intellectuals are in the background, that society cannot flourish. So intellectuals have to be given importance even in administration of the country, administration of the society, administration of any region. So there is no dichotomy like classical spirit and modernity. Sometimes Sanskrit is thrown into background, or classical traditions are thrown into background throughout the world in the name of modernity. People think that modern subjects should be taught instead of Sanskrit, instead of classical languages or classical linguistics or classical etymology or classical anything. There is a sort of prejudice against classical spirit in certain societies, including India also. So we have to come closer, and we should also try to imbibe that classical spirit, especially in the interest of world peace and in the interest of creating climate where intellectuals, spiritualists and materialists could live together. Dharma, Artha, Kama and Moksha, all the four should coexist. And in that, the classical spirit as enshrined in Sanskrit, that can play a very significant role, I'm quite sure. And that way, every classical spirit is to be welcome. And we should now think of not dissociating from other classical traditions of the world, but very firmly and cordially associating ourselves with other classical traditions of the world. Let us have a beginning in this university, the Department of Classics and Department of Southeast Asian Studies. They should have some regular interaction, and they should have, because they have a common cause, and that common cause is to imbibe, to invite that classical spirit, which is the need of the hour, in the interest of human unity and peace on this globe. That's all I thought I should talk to you. I don't know whether I presented my case so well, but any questions?
You can draw more if you have questions.
I'm curious about the continuance of Sanskrit even today. I mean, I've recently been working on an early 19th century Sanskrit sutra text, but, you know, even the radio broadcasts and, as you were talking about, journal publications and whatnot. In one might say this is a kind of neoclassicism, a kind of a very forced attempt to try to return to some older model. I mean, obviously you didn't have radio broadcasts in, you know, I don't know when the radio was invented, but whenever, before a certain period in time. So I'm wondering to what degree you see the kind of current use of Sanskrit in these different circles. The writing of poetry and literature, the, you know, radio broadcasts, the academic journals, to what degree you see that as a kind of neoclassicism, or to what degree you see this as a natural development of a continuing tradition?
Yes, first of all, I am not ashamed of informing you that when I joined the Ministry of Education, I thought that we should have radio program in Sanskrit. And we tried and tried and tried, but we could not succeed. Central Sanskrit Board also recommended. Board recommended, but that ministry which deals with this radio and all that, they did not agree to that suggestion. Mm-hmm. Then do you know how we ultimately agreed to introduce Sanskrit program from radio? We were inspired by Germany. West Germany was having a weekly Sanskrit program. Somehow somebody informed us that the West Germany is doing that. So then there was no, all obstacles were removed. I'm sorry, I didn't want to inform you all that, but you have raised this question. So then thereafter, now television also has the Sanskrit program, everything is there. But the spirit is very much there. There is nothing, it is not that it is being done forcibly. People are dedicated, people are working on their that. And one good thing about Sanskrit poetry or Sanskrit plays is that it has at least pan-Indian connections. It is not confined to one state or anything. So Sanskrit is not a state language. It is not spoken in the streets. No, nobody speaks that there. But it is understood. People speak. The conferences are held. And as a second language, it is very much in use everywhere. Of course, there are some local differences in local pronunciations in Bengal, in Punjab, in Bihar. In Bihar, there is a tendency to call all ba as ba. So Bihara has become Bihar, and we swallow the last short vowel a. My name itself, as it is written in English, Ram Karan. It is not Ram Karan, it is Rama Karana. But we pronounce it as Ram Karan. So there are some differences there in pronunciations. Every state says that my pronunciation is the best. Every state claims that. But it is not that. Every state has something or the other. For example, this J, Nya, conjunct consonant. It's a problem. And a linguist like Sumit Kumar Chatterjee, and I also contributed an article on that it is better to accept Gya as the pan-Indian pronunciation. Because there are so many people claim that my pronunciation of this sound is the perfect. Mm-hmm. Some people say na, jya, jya. That also is equally, because nya is not the, that palatal nasal sound is not nya, but it is nya, nya. So, pronunciational problems are there. Re also is not pronounced correctly everywhere. Nowhere it is pronounced correctly. Some people say re, some people say ru, some people say ra. Nowhere pronounced correctly. But people understand each other, and there is an understandability. So long as anybody is able to make him understand properly, it's all right, no problem. But there is no forcibility there. Whatever is there, that is natural. Of course, government had to take some action about about the position of Sanskrit in the schools. Of course, our Pollock had contributed an article. That dichotomy between modernity and classical, people think that the classical is anti-progress. In some high circles, this feeling is there. In some, especially on political grounds, they think that it is anti-progress, anti-prosperity. But it is not so. It helps this classical spirit will create. It is, there is nothing. There is no opposition to modernity in classical spirit. Kalidasa tells us. You know that Malavikagana Mitra Kalidasa tells us that Purana Mitteva, you remember that line? Purana Mitteva na sadhu sarvam na chapi kavyam navamitya vadyam santa pariksha nyatarat bhajante mudha paraprateyaneya buddhi. So we always welcome anything new, and Sanskrit is now doing everything, there is nothing. Yes.
Yes, I had a question about the so-called revival periods. It means that there is one model for classic style in literature and art. And a revival period means that so-called stage of classical art and classical literature is so strong that it's attracted by the artists later. And I want to illustrate it by Western history of art and Western history of literature. It is that the so-called golden Latin of Julius Caesar and Augustus is the model of the later Latinists. And there were revival periods of classical culture and golden Latin. There are several of them. In 800 AD, there is so-called Carolingian Renaissance, when Charlemagne reconstructs the idea of Rome and the idea of Latin according to the pattern of this golden Latin and this golden classical culture in Rome. But, and then it fades because later generations, they it is said that they fall into mannerism and that Renaissance fades and corrupts and so on. Then comes the High Renaissance in Italy in 15th and 16th century, and it's again a reconstruction of the classical Augustan models and so on in all levels of art and literature, poetry, anything. And it's very strong. And the last one is in 18th century, when Pompeii and the classic Greek monuments are rediscovered, and that's called the Greek Revival and Neoclassicism and New Antique. And so they are even kings are kind of. Kind of amateur archaeologists and Latinists and Grecists, and they love this classical culture, but they always look back at Augustan and late Republican Rome, and thereby they look back at Middle Asia, its western coast, and that Hellenistic art and architecture there. And there is one period in classical Western culture which is so attractive that it creates these revival periods, at least three of them. And it still lives. We see that Capitol Hill is built in a certain style, and it's that late Augustan style. So my question is, if there is anything in classical literature in India that is repeated in a similar way, that Sanskritists and poets and writers are so attractive to that they have to go look back at that style and that model. I think it's late Gupta or early post-Gupta and Kalidasa, etc. Can you name any such writers which have somehow reconstructed and revived something which is deemed classical earlier? In this period, which is called late Gupta and classic Sanskrit and classic Hindu arts and so on.
Thank you for this question. In fact, in Indian conditions, there has been a continuity of something like that. Of course, after the Ramayana and Mahabharata, Kalidasa was the first to come after Ramayana and Mahabharata. And Kalidasa, in fact, as I have shown elsewhere, Kalidasa he followed the tradition of the Mahabharata and Ramayana particularly, and in several of his poems he brought in the poetic formulas of the Mahabharata and Ramayana. So, but that thing ended with Kalidasa. Thereafter there was a sort of ornate poetry that came out. And that ornate poetry, of course, it was characterized by long compounds, lots of figures of speech, and it had its own beauty, its own charm. But then the tradition of composition, there was no vital change, as a matter of fact, there. And even now, what is happening today, it is all kinds of styles. There is not one style in which modern Sanskrit poetry or Sanskrit plays are being produced. But some are following this Japanese style of haiku. One or two such examples are there. There is one in Gujarat, Harshadev Madhav. You know him?
No, I don't know him. I know his work.
I met him very recently. Some people still now prefer to have the same style as it was in 11th century or 12th century. Some people are, of course, they do not follow any style, but as on the lines of the modern poets and all that. And what is more important is that in other languages, for example in Hindi, there are several Hindi poets who adopt the mythological themes as their central theme, and they bring about innovations there. For example, the very story of Karna. Karna was a Mahabharata figure, was the son of Kunti and son of the sun god. He was. Now the Mahabharata story is there. He was on the side of Kauravas, and he was not well treated by Pandavas, or these stories are there. But Dinkara, Ramdhari Singh Dinkar, he has produced a special poem on Karna himself, and he calls it Rashmi Rathi. Have you read it? Rashmi Rathi, you have seen it. So there, Indra comes to, and he asks for the congenital earrings and congenital that, what they call kavacha, armor, congenital armor of Karna. And Karna, without any hesitation, he gives away both those things which would have made him invincible. He gives that, gives away both these armor and earrings to Indra. So then Indra in Rashmi Rathi tells that today I am convinced why the earth is down and the heaven is up. Heaven is so light, it doesn't carry any weight. I represent heaven, and I have come all the way from heaven to beg. And this earth has given away what is considered to be sort of something which one must not give, but he has given me. So on account of the weight, the earth is down below, and the heaven is up without any weight or anything. So modern language poets also are contributing to bringing about that classical spirit in some form or the other, and they are also bringing about some innovations also in the mythical scenes and all that. So I don't know whether I have been able to give you a proper answer. Everything is there. We cannot say that only this thing is happening. Everything is happening. This is time.
But one thing which is...
One comment.
Yeah.
I know at least one revival period in culture, and that's the reconstruction of Chola dynasty in the Vijayanagara. And it follows the Chola's culture, Chola culture. On many levels, the Vijayanagara Empire is a kind of renaissance of Chola.
I see.
That one exists.
I think also, even contemporary, last couple centuries, and this is in light of his question that maybe you can say something, the model of Kalidasa, many things have been written before and after him.
That's right.
And they continue to be written.
Yeah, that's right.
But why, what is the... There's some modern history, some recent history, the last few hundred years, which has a lot to do also with the discovery of Sanskrit, discovery of this literature in Europe and elsewhere, that has produced a certain kind of a reconstruction, if that's when you use his words, of a kind of a
right.
What is classical spirit for
right.
Kalidasa. So
yes, it has happened based on Meghaduta, somebody, Stuart. Stuart composed a poem based on Meghaduta. It is just a Duta style. He composed a poem. So that also is there. There had been lots of interactions. So if you can take it as a sort of revival, the term revival somewhere and somehow some people do not quite appreciate it. But there is nothing wrong. There is nothing wrong in it. To revive something that is good, something that is unifying, and something that is Satyam Shivam Sundaram. But there is not one particular style which is being revived. Several styles are there. Not one style. Several styles are there. Some people are writing just prosaic poetry. There should be no rhyme, nothing of the kind, just prose only. blank words and all that. Some people are also trying that in Sanskrit also. So there is not one particular style that is growing, but there are several styles.
Would you also would you also include reversal as part of revival? I'm thinking of attempts to make of Ravana a hero. Ravana a hero. So that's kind of using classical material, but definitely in a non-classical way. So I just wonder whether you see part of the enduring revival of themes, or whether you find that on the contrary kind of rebellion and rejection.
I tell you, there is one such controversy. Very often I have come across a controversial item. Somebody has contributed a poem in Odia. And there also Karna is very much, he figures there. But what is controversial in nature is that it has been, she has depicted Draupadi's love for Karna. Draupadi's done it, and that book has been translated into Sanskrit. And there has been controversies, and some people have written that this is something which Rashtriya Sanskrit Samsthan government should not have helped, and
just as a follow-up, so you speak of translation of things, and so just these changes that are happening, these sometimes reversals. I know V. Raghavan's work in the 20th century of translating, you know, certain sort of staples of sort of the, you know, European canon, like Shakespeare, into Sanskrit idioms. Can you speak of some other things that you've come across where you see this flow? Because usually it's the other way around, right? We have translators doing Sanskrit into...
No, there have been quite a few. One Sharma, he was a member of parliament also, he was also from Odisha. He translated all Shakespeare's plays. I remember one or two titles. Yathate Rochate. As you like it. And similarly, Alpa Rambha Bahu Kriya. Much you know about that thing. So he had translated into Sanskrit, and it was very well received. Yes, come Mary.
It looks to me that this the very use of word classical is very foreign to the Indian way of thinking. So it's something recognized, something sophisticated. But also it seems, even if the dictionaries probably don't talk about it, it has acquired the connotation of something ancient. Working in the Caribbean islands, I was invited to a classical music event, and I was looking forward to some kind of Bharatanatyam or something of that type. And when I went there, I was very amused to see that there was the folk style chimta and the dholak, and that was called classical. And I think for them, people who have been separated from the Indian culture for 150 years or so, this was something that came from their fatherland, from their motherland. It was something at least relatively ancient, so they call it classical music for them. Something that, as you said, that would not have any kind of recognition in India for that kind of performance. It seems, you know, if we see that what we call classical as opposed to modern, then it just creates a problem, you know, really between, so it means the backward mode of Vedic and the post-Vedic, you know. So I think it's a continuum from the Vedas up to this day. What we speak today is just this end of the continuum that started in the Vedas, the Vedic Sanskrit. That's a linguistic continuum. And then also a continuum of ideas, as you described very correctly, Nuriri. And that also has been continuing. So this kind of dichotomy, this kind of division, that this is classical and this is modern, doesn't seem to be very right, doesn't seem to be very consistent with the traditional insight, thinking of the people in Uri. And as you were just giving some examples, even today, I mean, there are things that are very modern, but they coexist with themes, with ideas, with phraseology that is very classical, and they coexist. And this idea of coexisting in the domain of gunas and in many other domains is so germane to the very thinking, the very culture of that part of the world, you know. It seems to me that this dichotomy of classical and modern seems to be very artificial to me, really. But I could be wrong.
You are very right, and we find, for example, Sanskrit dramas. If you look at Sanskrit dramas, how many languages Sanskrit drama has used? Sanskrit is there. Maharashtri Prakrit is there. Magadhi Prakrit is there. Saurseni Prakrit is there. At least three Prakrits are there. Everybody understands everybody else. But everybody cannot speak Maharashtri Prakrit. Everybody cannot speak Saurseni Prakrit. Everybody cannot speak Magadhi Prakrit. Everybody cannot speak Sanskrit. But everybody understands every other's language. So, that the spirit of continuity and the spirit of what we can say transcendence of historical and geographical limits, that is very important. And what you said in the field of art and music, there are two things there. And one is the so-called classical music, classical Bharatanatyam, classical Kathakali, classical whatever you have, Kathak Nritya also you have, that is there. But apart from that, there are some rural classical traditions of various musical styles, various dramatic styles. They are in fact in the oblivion. People do not attach much importance to that. But to my mind, they are as classical Bharatanatyam and other things are there. So they also should be in the interest of continuity of classical tradition. They also must be encouraged, they also must be respected, honored. And what you are saying, in places like Mauritius, Trinidad, those people who have brought something from their villages, remote villages, that is classical. Whether you call them Shastriya Sangeet or not, they are as good Shastriya as other Shastriya Sangeet is there. I quite agree.
And I think one more point. Yes. There's a word for classical music that we have coined in more recent time that have gained currency now, Shastriya Sangeet. But it's difficult. How shall we say classical Sanskrit in Hindi or in Sanskrit?
They have Shrenya. They have translated classical in India as Shrenya. But I do not agree with that. I do not agree.
I heard that word for the first time in my life.
That is the literal translation of classical. Classical, class is Sreni. So from that Sreni. And I will tell you a big joke. There is a big joke. I have already told you that wherever there is a problem, they should take help from Sanskrit. That is true. But sometimes it is overdone. There was one eminent philosopher, Hari Mohan Jha. once he came to attend some meeting where technical terms were being discussed. So he came to see me. I asked him, how have you, everything has been done quite well. And he said, everything I have done with Mahilanguli Nyaya. It took me quite some time. What is this Nyaya? I am hearing it for the first time. There are so many Nyayas I have noted. This is, what is this Mahilanguli Nyaya? Then I asked him, I had to ask him, he was a philosopher, just possible he might have got this term from some Western philosophy or some other systems. Then he told me that there was an English term, lady's finger, for some vegetable. So that lady's finger has been translated as, if it is translated as Mahilanguli, so that will be an example of over-Sanskritization of every region has some words for everything. So this Srenya also seems to be Mahilanguli Nyaya. It is not a good translation.
And that goes back to what David was asking about, these attempts of sort of forcibly.
This is doing a forcible, kind of thing. No, this is nothing should be imposed on anyone. Even classical spirit must not be done in the sense of imposition. It should come naturally. It should come as natural. And if you attend some of these conferences, Sanskrit conferences, which are conducted through Sanskrit medium, you will find that natural thing there. And you will be very much impressed that people from all over the country assemble, and if they have any one language through which they could communicate, it's Sanskrit alone. Otherwise, Sanskrit and English, these are the two alternatives only. These are the two alternatives. Otherwise they cannot communicate with each other. Yes.
I certainly would like to thank you for opening up a discussion that we did not start at the beginning of this year, which is, what is this colloquium about? Because if we have a poster that's a classical and anti-classical, and we try to discuss, or we try to think it through from what you've heard, I think a lot of us walk away with something over. And you really have broken the issue. And I'd like to speak just briefly to counter the idea that classical is in any way the opposite of modern. That continuity of ancient and modern really is not, I think, a convergence of what a classical reference means. I would probably substitute the word foundational, but classical, what it recognizes as classical, is some moment or some occasion or some foundation on which other things are built. And so long as it's recognized as the foundation for what it was on, it can be called classical. And an extreme example of this in India today that I like to use is the fact that you have contemporary artists making a great success out of contemporary art. And much of what we now recognize as contemporary Indian art starts at independence with the progressives in Bombay and with painters who follow them. But the group of painters in between the current contemporary painters and the progressives are now called, including the progressives actually, are now called classic modern painters.
I see.
And I think it's actually a very good phrase, because it is these people who established the beginning foundations for what will be contemporary art in India for as long as it succeeds. And so long as there is a new tradition that starts with that foundation, and then to go back and call it classic serves a purpose. Mm. And then you get away from classic.
That's wonderful. Yes. There is a specific channel now for Bhojpuri, of course, that is my mother tongue. And I find there are some certain programs typical to rural areas. And I see in them that same classical spirit. They are all classical, I should say. So we have to widen the scope of the so-called classical spirit. We have to widen it. Thank you so much for your comments.
I guess what I'm hearing with a lot of the different questions that people are asking you, and also the aspects of your talk, the different aspects, are that there's classical in the sense of, as Michael put it, foundational, and which also has a sense of history. And then there's classical in terms of a kind of style that's accorded value and that's emulated. And then there's this third aspect, which is following the classical spirit. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe reflect a bit more on the relations among those three things.
Yes. Classical spirit is what we may call universal spirit, inclusive spirit, where there are no prejudices, where there are no caste prejudices, where there are no racial prejudices, where there are no national prejudices. So that universal spirit, that is the real classical spirit. Vasudhaiva kutumbakam yatra vishvam bhavatyeka nidam. And everywhere we have that. It is not only Sanskrit tradition, but all classical traditions speak of that universalism everywhere.
And so now the relation, I think Rupa was asking that, you know, when we speak of the other types, will we use classical in other contexts?
That's right.
Kalidasa represents the classical style, as yes. opposed to such and such. Or what was the other?
Kalidasa is an example of a classical style, but also by virtue of a kind of antiquity, right? There's always
So also history of time. That's something that sort of these generations back. So how does that aspect of constructing an idea of classical also directly?
But when you talk of Kalidasa as such, somebody asked me, what do you think about the age of Kalidasa? Some people say 2nd century BC, some people say 4th century AD, some people still say 6th century AD. So I said it is better. I know Kalidasa from 1936. So to me, Kalidasa was of 1936.
That's a nice
answer. But to me, Kalidasa, whatever his age might be, he is as modern as any other modern poet. He talks about service to the people. He talks about the love. He talks about the kings who had all so many good qualities, 16 good qualities he had mentioned about the rulers. And he had also presented the story of a pseudo king. And he has done it in such a nice manner, looks so modern. He says that king was so much fond of his personal amorous affairs that whenever being specially pressurized by his ministers that he must appear before the audience, before the people, so he could only demonstrate that appearance through his feet, through the windows. Only feet he could throw through the windows so that people could have darshana and people could be satisfied. I don't think anybody will write such a poetry criticizing a king. He was a king, Agni Varana, and he says that Gauravat yadapi jat mantrinam darshanam prakriti kaankshitam dadau tad gavaksha vivaravalambina pad padma yugalena kevalam. Pad padma. Yes, that is dungeon.
So along with, I have a question I think that sort of maybe you can. Do you think that that particular writers were writing in, say, in this specific case, classical writers, do you think there's a consciousness in them producing something classical in contrast to something else that they are also familiar with? You see, I mean, this is a, like, in terms of models, how they compose, how they think about their work, how we think about their work. I mean, what is the contrast?
You see, yes, the contrast is that poetry which looks embarrassing, even now when we read that, for example, somebody is flattering his king, supporter king, and he is saying that your fame is growing and it is pervading the entire atmosphere. And I have now doubts whether my wife will be able to maintain the blackness of her hair. I am afraid her hair could very soon may become brown or white on account of the spread of your fame. So such types of flattering poetry, it cannot continue for long time.
I see. So there's a certain conscious attempt that those authors who are composing in a classical style mm-hmm. expect their work to last.
That's right.
For generations. That there's a certain expectation in the work that's meant to not be. I guess that's part of the explanation. Specifically what Sanskrit literature I wanted to ask is, you know, their concerns are almost rarely journalistic, even though, of course, they're historical documents. They're products of a time, and they're reflecting a history. They're reflecting what's happening in whatever period that they're written. They're reflecting a local period, maybe other ideas. But in the construction of it, what is it in the construction of it that they try to take all that out?
Yes. So far, when it... Yes? Somebody was saying something?
No, you're just clearing it from.
You know, I will give you an example, a modern example, without mentioning the name of the author or the political leader. Somebody wrote a poem eulogizing a modern leader, very powerful leader. Unfortunately, that powerful leader was very badly defeated, and his book was to be released just the other day. Next day or something like that. And he was then afraid that if that book is now publicized or published and released, then the other leader who is coming, he will be annoyed and I will be nowhere. So that book was withdrawn overnight. Overnight it was withdrawn. So that type of poetry which depends on somebody, or which is done in a spirit of just getting some favor from rulers or from the kings and from the emperors, that poetry cannot last long. And even if it is a book of history, even if there are certain historical facts there, it cannot last, because for that they will read history. Better to know get the information from history rather than through poetry. Poetry is not history. Poetry is something which lasts, which transcends all geographical and historical limits. Of course, from that you could guess something, that is something you can get some historical information. But if it is just history, it is no poetry.
I will ask.
Yes, please.
About these poems, I have read that in this very eloquent and beautiful poetry, there are many metaphors which refer to contemporary conditions and persons here. And I guess it applies to Kamidasha too, and because that applies to Latin poets. They, for example, Catullus